Hello, everybody. This is Dane Gentry with the Standing Back Up Podcast. Today, I'm here with my guest, Mr. Daryl Rogers. We're going to be talking about how to deal as a parent with a child who is an addict and the steps we should take maybe to help them, the early signs, these type of things. How are you doing this morning, Daryl?
Doing great. Doing great. Good to meet you. Good to be here with you, Dane.
Thank you so much, man. I appreciate it. As we know, addiction is big for me. I had it, but my parents also had it. I saw it as a young age. So tell us how it was when you first found out. That was it. Chase, is that his name? I didn't write it down.
Chase. Okay. Yeah. So, you know, I'm not sure when things really started for him. I first began noticing some changes that were getting kind of problematic in the 10th grade, about the middle of the 10th grade. Grades were slipping all of a sudden, kind of developed kind of more of a rebellious attitude at home. Was changing the way he dressed a little bit, kind of changing some of the people he would hang out with. And he was failing one of his subjects. So that was kind of unusual for him. He was not like a straight A student or anything, but now all of a sudden, you know, it seemed like he had an attitude, his grades were slipping. So during the middle of his junior year, we transferred him to a military school in Virginia. And my whole thought was, you know, he was ADD, ADHD diagnosed early on. And I felt like that the structured environment and the discipline would be good for him. And that and I was right. I was right about that. It was good. And he was able to bring his grades up and he was able to graduate. And you know, from that standpoint, it was good. But while he was there, he got into a little bit of trouble here and there. He was still kind of experimenting a little bit. And then when he got to college, that's when things really got serious. After you know, first semester of college.
Do you know, did he start with like smoking marijuana or is that what was first? You're drinking maybe? Yeah.
I don't know which came first. I think they kind of came all together there, but it was marijuana and alcohol and just smoking cigarettes, you know, all of that kind of seemed to just happen all at once. And then from there into experimenting with a few other drugs like Molly, you know, things like that.
Yeah. See, all that was after me. Mine started the same way, smoking the cigarettes. And then I believe me and my brother were talking about it the other day. I believe I smoked pot before I smoked cigarettes. I think I don't remember. I started so young, but like I said, it was around in my life. Everybody done it. And it was
right.
I was like 9 years old. I mean, so I'm real young and, you know, how would I know to done it? Because I saw everybody doing it. I didn't, you know, did I really understand what I was doing? Probably not. But then I had an accident at 11, had some opioids, and the rest was history. Did he ever get to opioids, or was it just alcohol and those type of drugs?
Yeah, to my knowledge, the best of my knowledge, I don't think he ever got to the opioids. He was running with the crowd there, you know, near the end that he would have eventually, you know. But now, as far as I know, he never did.
And then I saw also y'all seen treatment one time, right?
Yeah. I actually had an intervention for him right here in our home, and the intervention was successful at getting him into treatment, and he did get better. He went from it was like a 30-day program, which I always tell parents I recommend longer programs. You know, I know they're expensive, he went from that into a sober living environment, a halfway house, and he ended up bouncing around to several different ones, spent probably 9 months total in Florida before he came back home here.
Florida seems to be the treatment, sober living home, capital of the world. I was just talking to a guy. I'm in Nashville area, and we have started a sober living home here in program, a very nice one. We're trying to keep it very low on the amount of men that we have here. That way we can work with them as much as we can on an individual basis versus having 10 or 12 people in a, um, in, in a, environment, kind of the same environment that you had when you was drugging, you know, and that's where a lot of these places are at. And what we have found is that we got to remove ourselves completely from the environment.
Yeah.
And so we thought, well, we'll spend up, get a nice home and nice big home and, you know, gym membership and these kind of things and see if there's a difference. And we're going to give it a try, man. But I agree with you. The longer you can stay in treatment, the better. But even then, man, you know, it's up to us.
Yeah, for sure.
We get all the tools, and I had them too. I was given, I went to treatment probably 10 times, I guess. And then, of course, prison and all these different things. And for me, what finally got it for me was God. I'm just going to, you know, we can go to the best treatments in the world. We can spend all the money in the world. But if we don't put God first, none of it's going to work.
That's right.
Yeah. How long did it take me to relapse after the treatment and all?
About 9 months. And, you know, I don't know. I mean, my thoughts on some of that have changed a little bit over time. I think maybe it was in a little bit of trouble with some of the people he was hanging with or through them. Potentially, you know, it seemed like there was somebody after him because he had come to me and said, look, I'm hanging really with a rough crowd again. I need to get away from these people. I'm moving. And he had taken a job transfer back to treatment or to the area where he had been in treatment. He knew somebody there that had a place he could stay. That was a guy that was in recovery. It was an older guy. And so he was planning to leave, and it was really the day he was supposed to leave is when everything happened.
What part of Florida did he go to for treatment, if you don't mind me asking?
He was in, let's see, I know he was in Deerfield Beach at one time, but I think that's where he was in the sober living homes. He was a little bit further north of there, and I can't remember the name of the town right off the top of my head now.
I was in West Palm,
right in that area.
Yeah, I was in the West Palm Lake Worth area.
Okay,
man, there was
farther south.
Yeah, there was treatment centers everywhere. I mean, it was just, and I can easily say 90% of them were all for profit. That's all it was about. It was money, especially the sober living homes, and that's and even here where I'm at, there's a million of them, and that's what they are, but they all got that reputation. And that's why we feel and know, yes, we're spending a lot of money out of pocket, but it's going to be worth it because we're going to see people succeed, and it's not all about making the money. And,
you know, all of that it totally caught me off guard. I didn't know anything about addiction. I didn't know anything about the treatment process or, you know, I was just a desperate father trying to save his son's life. And, you know, I started learning really quickly, like some of the things that you're talking about.
Yeah.
Pretty sure there was some patient brokering going on there, you know, and, he bounced around to a lot of different halfway houses while he was there. And really the last one that he was in, I felt like was a good one. It was the best one he had been in. And the other ones were really poorly run. Most of them from what I could tell, of course he had an attitude a little bit too, you know, but this last one, you know, just talking to the guy there, the manager, he was a really good guy to talk to. And he always kept me in the loop on what was happening. And, I liked it, but, and he seemed to like it, but there was a girl that he met there that left and, he had actually met her in treatment and had invited her to that sober living home. Mm-hmm. And when she left, he was ready to go. So he kind of did some things to make them mad at him and get himself kicked out.
I wish I could tell you how many times I've heard that same exact story right there.
I'm sure.
That is the biggest mistake that I think Florida makes is putting men and women together like they do. Mm-hmm. It is a bad idea. And no matter what they do in them treatment centers, there's going to be the hookups. It's going to happen. Yeah. And that's when you can tell. Like I was in one down there and I come in from work one night. I was actually working, started, I got a job at another treatment center, and I come in from work and there's a girl in my room. And I'm like, you know, where did you come from? She's like, oh, I just moved in. And I'm married, and my wife's in Tennessee. And I'm like, no, this is not going to work. And they're like, oh yeah. So I called her and she's like, well, you gotta be kidding me. And I was like, they do it on a regular basis. And that guy had been in commercial real estate and then just saw the money in it and then decided, hey, I'm gonna start these sober living homes. And then here we go. But okay. So is that when he had the accident after he left from there?
Yeah. When he came back home and yeah, there's a lot of other things that happened in there for a little while, but yeah. He had been back home about 9 months and that's when he told me, hey, I'm moving away. I'm in trouble with this crowd and I'm getting ready to move back to Florida. He had taken a job transfer there and the day he was supposed to leave to go to Florida is when the wreck happened. He was still here. Apparently there'd been a big going away party the night before. And there was all kind of drugs and alcohol consumed there with him and his buddies. And, some of them, he and a couple of his friends, I'm not sure who all was there. I know a couple of them that were there because they ended up in the car. They all went to a park near our home and they smoked some marijuana there. And what I was told through the grapevine was that they woke up feeling hungover that morning from the party the night before. And they were like, well, let's go smoke some weed at the park to help us cope with our nausea. And so they did go to the park. They did smoke the marijuana. All of that's in the police report. And they got right in the car right after smoking. And they did make a quick stop to grab a bite to eat and then right out on the I-40 in rush hour traffic. And she didn't make it but a couple of miles and she lost control. So it was his car, but he let this 18-year-old girl that had smoked with them, another girl he had dated at one time, he let her get behind the wheel of his car. He was in the front passenger seat. Another kid was in the back. They only made it a couple of miles and lost control in a curb. And the car left the road, kind of spun out of control, left the road and struck a tree, and he died at the scene.
When you say I-40, Tennessee?
No, it's right here in North Carolina. You know, I've driven I-40 from here up through Asheville on up into Tennessee before. But it's, right here in close to where I live, close to the Raleigh area. It runs on down, you know, to Wilmington.
Yeah. All right, man. So if you were talking to a parent out there, what would be the first sign you would tell them to look for in their child? Just a change in behaviors or?
Yeah, you know, that's everybody asks that question. It's kind of a tough one. Well, not everybody, but a lot of people do. And it is kind of a tough one because, you know, when you have a teenagers are going through a lot of changes in life anyway.
Yes, they are.
You got all the hormones are raging and they're trying to figure life out and their brain's getting all wired up and everything is still not completely there. And they're trying to figure this whole thing out. So, it's normal that they're going to be a little bit rebellious, you know. I would say look for changes. Definitely the drop in grades, I think, was a big warning sign. And I knew something was up, but I didn't know what. And I was trying to get a handle on it. So, drop in grades, drop in if they become disinterested in sports, if there are other activities, which that didn't happen with our son, but I know talking to other parents, it does happen a lot of times. He was still interested in sports and still actively participating in sports. And I think when we got him to the, military school, you know, he couldn't use, I mean, there were things getting smuggled in. I have no doubt about it, but it was a little bit more difficult for him to be able to use there. So, and he liked playing football. So I don't think there was a whole lot going on there, but if they get depressed or they want to isolate, again, not him, but I see it with other kids. If it's out of character for them, it can be one of the warning signs that the rebellious nature, hanging with a new group of friends, that can be a warning sign if it's out of character for them and coupled with other warning signs, you know.
Yeah.
So those are just some of the things I would look for. Of course, you can look for the, you know, the dilated pupils, you know, red eyes, you know, red bloodshot looking eyes, things like that. You know, for him, I was witnessing what I would describe as a cognitive decline or more of a, like a just don't care attitude. You know, I think that's a marijuana thing more so than a lot of other drugs. It's just kind of a, hey, everything's cool, man. You know, there's nothing to worry about. Everything's going to be okay. And it's just kind of a laid back kind of attitude where, you know, things don't really matter that should matter.
You know, what's, you know, the funny thing, it's not funny, but it's kind of, it's very weird to me how society has become like, oh man, it's okay. They're smoking a little bit of weed. Yeah. No, man, it is not okay. You know, I'm not talking about an adult. I'm talking about kids, you know.
Yeah.
I don't use any drugs and that's how I live my life, but I do know adults who do drink a beer or something and smoke some weed and they're successful. Mm-hmm. But when we're talking about a child, it's a gateway. I do not care. People can try to tell me I'm wrong till they're blue in the face and I'm going to sit there and argue back with them because I know better. I've watched it. I saw it firsthand and I lived it. And we need to be more. I just can't believe they're just passing all these laws and you can go in basically a gas station and buy marijuana pretty much almost. And it's sad, man. It's a sad thing because you get that buzz and you want something else. And oh man. And it's that laid back behavior, what you were just talking about, that kind of attitude of, because that weed's got you relaxed, got you whatever. And you're not thinking the same way. And even though you look over here and see this person who's, let's just say, doing heroin and their life is completely out of control, living on someone's couch, ain't got no job, ain't got no money. You think in your mind, yeah, man, it'd be okay to do some of that.
Yeah.
I mean, come on, man. You know, I was that person, you know, I saw it and someone asked me that and they're like, well, how do you, and I said, it's just the insanity of the addiction, man.
A couple of things on that. For one thing, you know, the teenage brain is still developing, until about age 25, plus or minus a year or two, you know. So it's very susceptible to addiction. You know, people, all of the studies have shown that people who start in their teen years, the earlier people start, the more likely they are to develop an addiction later on. So if we can delay the experimentation or the use of those drugs until they're a little bit older, then, and including alcohol, then we've got a much better chance at them being able to use it and experiment a little bit here and there without, you know, developing an addiction. Of course, it's a little bit dangerous, a little more so than when I was a teenager, obviously, to experiment now because you've got things like fentanyl out there and drugs can be laced. I think most of that is usually accidental, you know, just, you know, people handling different drugs and it just accidentally happens that they get some fentanyl mixed in there, but it can happen even with marijuana. I've heard of people smoking marijuana and it accidentally, you know, it was laced with fentanyl. So it is a really dangerous thing for teenagers. And then the other thing is really, you know, I graduated from high school in 1978. So,
okay. Yeah.
Tells you a little bit about how old I am, you know, people were smoking weed around me when I was in high school and it went on a lot, you know, and I had really strict parents that I also had a lot of respect for and they did a good job raising me. And so, yeah, there was times when I was tempted by peer pressure, but I never caved to it, you know, thankfully. But the thing I would say about it is knowing other people, having friends now who did smoke back then and just knowing what I know from studying is that the marijuana then and really all the way up until the early, maybe even the mid 90s, the THC content was about 2 to 3%, yep, versus anywhere around 18 to 25% now, depending on what somebody's smoking. And that doesn't include all the other forms that they can get, like the dabs, the shatter, you know, it could go up to 60% plus. And I mean, that's a huge leap. So it's much more addictive. And it can, you know, I'm hearing of things from parents like cannabis induced psychosis, some of the other things like cannabinoid hyperemesis syndrome. You know,
I haven't heard of that one. I haven't heard of that one, that last one. Yeah.
They will. And I'm sure it's related to the higher THC content, but they'll start to throw up and they cannot stop unless they completely cease use of any cannabis products.
I'm glad you just told me that, because I'm gonna say it on the air too. We have, they're my stepchildren, but one's in the Marines and he's in North Carolina, and the other one is at home and he's 18. And a couple of months back, he admitted to his mom that he had been buying some of the vapes online, and of course made the promises. We're watching his bank account, his credit cards, and oh, I promise I'm not going to do it. But you know me, I'm the drug addict and I'm the crafty one. And so I'm always going, I don't believe it. And now he's going through this throwing up phase and we can't figure out what it is. And with what you just told me, I think, you know, we have drug tests around and I think it's time to him for him to get one. Neither one of our boys were any trouble at all. They had both. Well, he's isolation has always been. He was homeschooled since he was 11 and he pretty much stays in his room, does his things. And we didn't expect this to happen. Now, the older one who was in the Marines, he experimented more because of his dad. Their father killed himself almost 2 years ago. And when he did that, the oldest one told us some things that I said was going on. Beth never would believe it. You know, she didn't want to believe it. I found some things in his room, but then the drinking thing. And now being in the Marines, he's an alcoholic. I mean, and the dad was too. Let me say that the dad, the grandmother, on and on. And so it was all around him, but I'm glad you just told me that about that throwing up thing. Cause, it makes sense to me with Caden now.
Yeah. They tend to take a lot of hot showers.
Oh yeah.
Because the hot showers, they will find out really quickly, help relieve the nausea. Mm-hmm. And there's some science behind that I can't really explain, but you can look it up online and you can find some things that will help you understand that a little bit. But in fact, they will do it so much so that they, some of them will develop scars on their back from the burns from getting in the hot shower. Yeah.
Wow, that is crazy. I remember I was just having a conversation about the potency of the marijuana, though. Like I was saying, when I was a kid, every now and then someone would be called skunk, generation one or generation two. Like that was a high potent marijuana. And I think it was hydroponically grown or something back then. Now that's what it all is. I mean, and everywhere we go, you smell it. And the last time I smoked was probably 8 years ago. I quit smoking probably a long time ago, but I got so paranoid from it, from where it was so, the THC levels were so high. And I think, you know how kids nowadays walk around, they all walk around with these hoodies on, man. It'd be 100 degrees outside. You think that has something to do with it? You think that's the marijuana doing it?
I don't know.
I just wonder.
I think it could just be a fashion thing.
Yeah.
I don't know, but yeah. Yeah. You've got the cannabinoid hyperemesis syndrome. You've got the psychosis issues. And I know parents personally, just through some of my connections, who have lost a child to suicide because of cannabis-induced psychosis. So a lot of people poo-poo that notion and they think, oh, there's no, that doesn't happen. You know, you're just imagining it. But yeah, it does happen more frequently than people realize. And then there's the whole impaired driving issue. If they're, and you can see what happened to our son. I mean, if they're smoking marijuana, they're probably smoking it pretty often, and they're probably high. They're probably driving impaired.
Yeah.
And if they do that long enough, they're going to end up in a wreck.
Yep. You're right.
So,
without a doubt. Caden can't drive anyway. He's the worst driver I've ever seen in my life already. he doesn't drive a lot, and thank God that he doesn't. It's pretty bad, but
you mentioned the Marines and here in North Carolina. And so they haven't called me lately. I don't know if I made them mad or what, but they used to call me down there all the time to speak. The two closest to us, two Marine bases close to us are Cherry Point. I want to say I've been to Cherry Point once to speak, but the other one is, it's right on the tip of my tongue.
Camp Lejeune?
Camp Lejeune, yeah.
Yeah, that's Camp where Lejeune, David is. Yeah. Yeah.
I've been there a lot to speak over the years, a lot. And I speak some in Fayetteville also at Fort Bragg. You know, mm-hmm. I have a military background too. I was Army National Guard 12 years. But yeah, there's a lot of issues with the marijuana, and we got 420 coming up, you know.
Yeah, and, man.
You know, I used to be an old fuddy-duddy, you know, kind of guy, and I'm not like that anymore. I understand addiction. I understand why people – I didn't used to. I understand how people – I got a pretty good idea. You know, I've never had to deal with it myself, so I can't walk in somebody else's shoes who's been there. But I do understand a lot better than I did. And I have a lot of empathy for people who are going through that. And, you know, I'm not against somebody having a good time.
Right.
You know? And even if somebody, you know, like, you know, you're talking about adults who want to use marijuana. Well, I think it's a mistake.
Me too.
But if that's what they want to do and they do it in a responsible way and they don't get on the roads impaired, you know, okay, but let's keep it out of the hands of minors,
without a doubt.
And, you know, give them a chance for their brain to develop before they are exposed to it. You know, that's my big thing with that.
Yeah, I agree. 1,000,000%. Mine, you can see, I was already smoking the weed very regular, and I could hit by a truck when I was 11 walking home from school. And so I kept having to have these surgeries. And when I was 15, they had to drill into the mastoid, the bone back there behind my ear, and do some draining. And they gave me a Vicodin ES pain pill. And so my addict brain was already running. And as soon as I took that pill, man, the rest was history. And then everything just spiraled out of control so fast. And there I went. And it took me a long time because it just seemed like everything just built up. And then I got sober and I just thought, hey man, you know, everything's fine. I'm sober. And then boom, all that stuff hit me. I stayed sober, but I had to get through, dealing with the real reasons of why I was using and what was going on. Mm-hmm. That's what we need to try to get to, man. The root causes, you know, what we're doing.
I think a lot of people are dealing with, you know, trauma, and trauma can be, it's different things for different people, right? What's a traumatic experience for one person might not be for another. And I think people automatically go to, oh, if it's trauma, this, you know, has to be, you know, abuse at home, you know, child abuse or something. And that's not, there's so many other things that can be trauma for, you know, for, it could be a kid in a school play standing on the stage and they mess up and they're embarrassed in front of everybody. That could be a traumatic experience that somebody just destroys their confidence. You know what I mean? Yep. And they don't ever bounce back from that. So there could be a lot of different things, for different people, but, you brought up the opioids, you know, the wreck and everything. That does bring up something for me in Chase's story where there's a little bit of a parallel there. And I've always wondered about it, but there's no way to know for sure. When he was an Eagle Scout, and when he was still a life scout. He was helping a friend of his with his Eagle project, and their family had a big farm, and out there on the farm, they had some go-karts that were like off-road type go-karts, mm-hmm. and they let him jump on the go-kart. I'd been on them before. He'd been on them before. It was not a big deal, you know. He was buckled in with a 5-point restraint, had a helmet on. It's got a roll cage, all of that. So you think, how much safer can you get, right?
Yeah.
But with it being off-road, it's got a little bit higher CG. So he's doing these power slides, and he hit a hard piece of ground, and it just rolled on him. And when it did, his arm kind of, the centrifugal force kind of threw his elbow out like that, and his elbow smacked the ground, and it just shattered his arm just from really just above the elbow all down into his forearm. And he had to have something like 29 screws, and he had a plate here, you know, around his elbow. And I'll never forget when he woke up when he was in recovery, you know, and the nurse explained to him, she said, you got this little button here you can press. And if you feel pain, and every time you press that button, it'll give you morphine to help you with the pain, but it's only going to give you morphine about every 15 minutes or so, no matter how many times you press the button, or however, it might've been 15, you know, plus or minus a little, I think that's what it was. So he would hit that button, and then pretty soon he was going to town on that button. Yeah. Right. And I've always wondered, you know, I probably would have been doing the same thing, but it was really not too long after that. It was really the next year. I think it was the next year, maybe later that year, where I began noticing these changes in him. And I've always wondered if there was a connection there. Now, he never experimented with the opioids, to my knowledge. But my whole thing is, well, that gave him a big shot of dopamine, right?
Yep.
And even though he didn't go to opioids, he was using other things to help boost that dopamine.
I think you're dead on right, without a doubt.
So, I mean, there's always that possibility. And then the other, there's a correlation with ADD, ADHD diagnosed kids. And he was on a low dosage of Concerta. We always tried to keep it low. He was having a hard time functioning in the classroom without it. So there's that too, you know. Anyway, you just made me think of that.
When I had my accident at 11. Now, at that time, I was already smoking weed and had even been drinking a little bit at 11. I don't remember how regular I had been smoking weed, but in the hospital, I was hurt really bad. And it took like 6 weeks to recover or whatever it was. But when I first woke up and they took me out of ICU or whatever, put me in a room, I could get a pain shot and they would give it to me in my legs, though. I didn't have the button. My mother said that it was every 3 hours I could get it. She said, I would get it. I would be asleep. And she said, I would wake up dead on money at the 3 hours and hit that button for them to come give me that shot.
Wow.
And I remembered it, but I wouldn't take the pain pills when I came home. But I kept on partying and doing acid and mushrooms and all these different things. And then when I was 15 and they gave me the opioid, I wouldn't even take it at first either. I wouldn't take the pill at first because I didn't know. Like, my mind wasn't registering what it was. And then an older girl actually is the one who's like, well, you should take one of those pills. Bad mistake. And I did, because I feel like it took my mind instantly back to when I was 11, and I remember the way it felt and what it done. Yeah, without a doubt. All right, man. The big secret to recovery from addiction is?
It's the family. The family, yeah. Yeah. This is a thing that a lot of families miss. They especially early on, when they first discover their loved one, particularly parents discovering their child has an addiction, their first thought is, there seems to be, if I can just get them into treatment, you know, they will fix them and everything will be okay. And what they don't realize is if they are successful at getting them into treatment, the first thing they should do while their child is in treatment is begin working on themselves. Because it does, the addiction does affect everyone in the family, and people begin to behave in different ways. A parent, out of fear, will engage in enabling behaviors, and they don't know how to set and maintain healthy boundaries. And as a result, they that can contribute to a relapse. If a child comes back home from treatment, it can help. It will tend to keep the child stuck in addiction because the parents are still treating them like they're a child, right?
Yeah.
So I agree. Parents have to learn how to back off of that. And there's a lot of fear and other emotions, fear and shame involved in all of that. And that's where they need some help. That's where the parents need help.
Yeah, I've said it a million times. I said, you know, here we are. I saw it in my wife. Like I would go to treatment and I was being worked on and going, you know, she even said it one time, you're being catered to while I'm at home and I'm getting nothing. I'm still stuck here with everything that's gone on and done. And of course I'd come back and immediately it would get brought up and whoa, nope, I don't want to talk about it. Out of shame, out of guilt, out of all these different things that we do. And I've said it. And then, when I was in Florida working at a treatment center, I went to them and I said, hey, have you ever thought about, you know, bringing in a family dynamic to it, have a family counselor do it. And said, and of course their first thing was, well, we have to see if we can build insurance for it. You know, that was the very first word, you know, and it was just like, so that's what Beth has done now. My wife, she bless her heart. She didn't know and understand addiction, didn't know anything about it until me. And she saw firsthand every bit of it. And so now she works in treatment herself also, but she is about 4 weeks away from her master's degree in alcohol and drug counseling. And,
awesome.
at 50 years old. And so, that's her. And that's what we want to do. We want to try to help. Like I've got them. We feel like we're the perfect team in a sense, because, you know, I made my life a living HELL without a doubt. You know, I did. You know, I could sit here. I used to blame everything in the world. Can't blame anyone but myself. No matter what, I still made the choices to do the things that I've done. Mm-hmm. I want to work with younger people and older people too, but I want to work with younger people too. And I want it to be raw, to show them what your life is going to be if we don't cut this out, but at the same time, loving them through it. And then her working with the families at the same time and them as well. And so that's the path we're on now, man. And so I love the family.
That's great. I love it.
Yeah. We feel like we're still trying to iron it out. We met with a guy from a very prominent treatment center here yesterday about what we were trying to do. We seem to be on the right track. He's been in it a long time. And like I told him, I said, you know, I feel we're the perfect package, man. We have it tenfold here. Everything. There's nothing you can get by me. I'm pretty crafty. I was a very crafty drug addict. And so I know all the signs and symptoms and then her, the loving side. And so we're praying for success for people. We want to see them change. I want to see people change. And hopefully we will. God willing, we will.
Absolutely.
We need more places like that. And I believe a lot of places start out that way where they truly care and want to help. Mm-hmm. And then money comes in and gets in the way. Insurance pays a lot of money to these treatment centers, as you know.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, you know, I didn't know until I went to work in it. And I immediately became the lead head tech there. And that's when I knew, I was like, man, I think I want to stay in this field. And but here we are, man. And we're going to give it a shot and see what happens. You do have a book, right?
Yeah. The book is A Life Half Lived, A True Story of Love, Addiction, Tragedy, and Hope. They can actually they can download it for free if they go to darylrodgers.com, darylrodgers.com. It's available on Amazon as well.
All right, my friend. I want to thank you so much for your time.
Thank you.
I've had a few military guys on, and the very first one, I said, thank you for your service. And I saw him kind of, and I was like, did I say something wrong? He's like, man, that's just one of them things we don't know how to respond to. So thank you for your time in the military, my friend.
Thank you.
You're more of a man than I was. I never even, I wished I would have done it. My life maybe could have been so much different, but either way, condolences for your loss. I couldn't imagine losing a child and the pain that must be. And so my heart goes out to you and my hat goes off to you for what you're doing, trying to help others, man. That shows your heart. I mean, that's a true human being. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you for having me here today.
Anytime, man. Anytime you need to talk, come on, just shoot me a little message or email and we'll get it done, my friend. Thank you so much.
All right. Thank you, Dane.
Have a good rest of your day. Stay safe.